Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. And as I've mentioned a few times, that's a statement of aspiration bodhicitta and action bodhicitta, which is our one job as bodhisattvas or aspiring bodhisattvas. Hello to Namdak and Fanny. So does anybody have anything to say before we do our meditation? So last week, we did a really intense and lengthy guided meditation. And if you weren't here for that, I recommend it. It's based on Bingo Chense's commentary. He has a guided meditation in it on pages 108 to 110 for basically taking and sending. Like, it's really detailed and really vivid and intense and really good to do that if we can. I mean, you've always got it in the book. So I recommend as part of your practice from time to time or regularly. It's a really good meditation to do to really help bring up, you know, the true heartfelt feeling of taking and sending, like the real wish to relieve the or eliminate the suffering of all sentient beings and take it upon oneself so that they can be free of it and to send them all of our happiness and peace. But today we'll do, you know, a shorter one in keeping with our usual, you know, our usual approach. But it's still going to, it'll be basically the same thing. If we're going to, you know, do taking and sending, but we're not going to do Dingo Chenseys again just because it's a long one. So first we check in with our posture as always and just get comfortable. Like, get comfortable on your cushion or chair and settle into a posture of your spine being straight, your hands being, you know, settled somewhere, your gaze being settled, your jaw not being tense. And just, we won't do a body scan today, but just letting our attention and our presence settle into the feeling of being in our body. And I just wanted to say, which I forgot to say earlier, just to orient us, especially for anyone listening to the audio later, we are on verse 11. We're in our second week on verse 11, exchanging one's own happiness for the suffering of others. So we're very settled and stable and resting in this sense of being in our relaxed, straight and stable body in this present moment, wherever we may be. And we'll just rest like that for a moment. And then while maintaining that sense of presence and awareness, we will very briefly review the four thoughts to strengthen our motivation, to remind ourselves of our motivation for being here and doing this practice together. So first, appreciating the precious human existence. We're so lucky to have this opportunity, and right now we're so lucky not to have been devastated by, you know, a hurricane that we're having to spend all of our time, you know, recovering from. But we actually have leisure to do our practice. And then remembering impermanence and death, that this opportunity will end, and we don't know when that will be, so we need to make use of our precious human existence now while we have it. And then karma, that our future in this lifetime and future lifetimes is up to us. So we can act in ways that will cause future suffering, or ways that will cause future happiness, or ways that will liberate us. And then fourth, the reason that we need to liberate ourselves, the reason that that kind of activity is really important, is that there's no reliable happiness anywhere in confused existence, even when it seems like happiness that leads to suffering. So our goal should be for ourselves and others to free ourselves completely from the cycle of samsara. And that's what we're going to work on today. So now within this state of resting and being highly motivated to engage in practice, we'll just follow our breath for a few moments. Just completely relaxed, not trying to breathe in a particular way, just noticing each in-breath and each out-breath as they occur, letting thoughts go as they arise. Just keeping a small part of our attention on our breath so we don't lose track of it within the greater awareness of our mind. And now we will arouse ultimate bodhicitta, our connection with our true nature, the nature of mind, our Buddha nature, beginning by looking at all experience as a dream, especially any thoughts or judgments or opinions that may be arising, recognizing their impermanence, their lack of solidity, their illusory nature, just resting in that. And then we turn our attention inward to examine the nature of awareness, which is unborn. Just looking at our own mind, seeing if we can draw any conclusions about it, if it has any characteristics we can identify, any limitations. Just looking. And then to bring ourselves fully to rest in the nature of our mind, we let any conclusions we drew about it, any thoughts we have about it, release naturally, let even the remedy release naturally. So there's no conceptuality remaining in our mind other than, like, it doesn't become conceptuality until we fixate on a thought. The thoughts are not conceptuality, they're just fleeting phenomena. So we just rest in the essence of mind, the basis of everything. Not blocking anything, but not following anything. Letting it flow naturally. And now within this state of openness, and the Chidren's instruction for ultimate bodhicitta is just to flash openness. Within this state of openness, we practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. And the way we're going to set that up today, amongst the many methods we could use, is to stay with. First, we're going to really go back to and stay with that resting in the essence, the basis of everything, that sense of just open, limitless awareness. And one way we can do it that Kali Rinpoche taught is that if we're following our breath on an out-breath or several out-breaths in a row, we visualize or we have a sense of our breath not being limited to the space around us or to any space, but simply continuing to move outward to all of limitless empty space, to the ends of the universe, and our awareness going with it on the out-breath. If it helps to visualize that on several out-breaths, that's fine. Or whenever you feel like you have a sense of that limitlessness of awareness, that openness and limitlessness, you can just rest there. And then resting in that limitless, vast, empty, awareness with no characteristics, nothing to identify. We imagine it completely filled, the infinity of space completely packed with sentient beings. All humans on the planet Earth, all animals on the planet Earth, and throughout the universe, if there are other Earths in the universe, everywhere there's life, every form of life, all the hungry ghosts in the universe that we can't see, all the hell beings, including humans who live in a hellish state of mind, all the gods, even though they don't know they're suffering, they are suffering and they are considered sentient beings for that reason. All the six realms, beings, and any other kinds of beings that may exist, we think that they fill space completely. It's completely animated with all these individuals. We've all been our mothers or our benefactors in previous lives. We have a connection with each and every one of them. And they're all suffering because they're sentient beings, because they have ego claim, because they have and fall under the sway of emotional afflictions, desire, ignorance, desire, anger, and so forth. And we just get a sense in our heart of this tremendous suffering, filling the entire universe, intermittent for many beings, constant for other beings, different from being to being, so many varieties. And we wish fervently in a heartfelt way for them to be free of suffering because they have been close to us in previous lives, because we're connected with them, because our happiness cannot ever be complete while they're suffering. So right now we're just developing that wish to free them from suffering and just having a sense of the immensity of the space that they occupy. And then we begin the visualization of taking and sending, breathing in the form of dark, smoky light, if that's helpful, or just the sense of breathing in all of the suffering of all the beings in the universe, into through our nostrils, through all the pores in our body, into our heart center, our vast, limitless Buddha nature, where it can dissolve along with our breath. Breathing out to all of them, whatever relieves their suffering, all happiness, all virtue and merit, having all of their needs met, having peace of mind, being relaxed and so forth, feeling love, whatever they all need. On each out-breath or every few out-breaths, we send them that, alternating with taking in their suffering. And if any individual beings or groups of beings in any of the six realms come to mind, we can also think of them while maintaining our vast scope of all sentient beings. And if you lose the thread of it, if your mind wanders a little bit, you just come back as soon as you notice. Mm. And if it becomes abstract, just a thought, then you try to bring it back into your heart and your feelings. Like really feeling that, really generating that strong compassion, that wish, that deep wish, that deep distress at the thought that anyone could be suffering. And we can include ourselves in this. Breathing in our own suffering, breathing out happiness to ourselves as well. Perhaps bringing to mind someone that we don't get along with, someone, whether it's a personal connection or, you know, just someone we know about. That we don't have a good feeling towards naturally, bringing them to mind and seeing if we can include them in this heartfelt wish and take in their suffering and send them happiness and really feel joyful about it. And without making too much of an effort or being too contrived, we really try to make it as, or let it be as vivid as possible, really putting ourselves in that place of being aware of the suffering that beings have. And that's why it's sometimes helpful to bring particular people or other beings to mind. So breathing in your suffering, breathing out happiness, relaxation, peace of mind, all needs met, awakening. And thinking at the end that all beings, including ourselves, are completely free from suffering, completely happy and content, and completely awakened. We're all Buddha now. I just rest in the feeling of that for a moment. And then letting go of the visualization and all thoughts, we come back to rest just in the essence, the basis of everything, the nature of our mind, without any conceptuality. Just an open, vast awareness. Now we can come back and be ready to study, move around, stretch, whatever we need to do. Have a sip of water, like me and Kathy. Okay, so we will now chant the verses together. We're going to chant them all today. It only takes a few minutes. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat, to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To give up all my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, This is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest, will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade, kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims, not following the friends who harm my practice. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane, constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Who can the worldly deities protect, themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail? The three jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail, to seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So those were the preliminaries that we keep working on. And now the three levels of motivation, which is the beginning of the main teachings, the path. The sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. To strive in all our efforts just for that, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. My mother's each and every sentient being, since time without beginning cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. And so with verse 10, we're into aspiration bodhicitta, and now we begin the real path of action bodhicitta with today's verse. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone, while focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for others' suffering, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And we'll recite that last one more time. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone, while focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for others' suffering, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. I think we lost Fanny. Oh, well. If you're listening, Fanny, I'm sorry we lost you. So, forgot what I was going to say. So we'll just go on. This is a very pivotal verse, as we discussed last week. Extremely important foundation. This is the main tool. This is actual, like, action bodhicitta. This is what we can actually do to help sentient beings, even though it's just meditation. So the first step, my interpretation of this is that the first step in action bodhicitta, in actually being able to roll up our sleeves and help other sentient beings, is to prepare our own mind to generate wisdom and compassion through the motivation that we generated in verse 10, which is to cultivate the mind of full awakening, full development of wisdom, full development of compassion. And as we've learned, both in this text and the Right Path of Awakening, relative, and we discussed it last week, relative bodhicitta is where you start. Teachers, you know, the great teachers seem to agree that it's too hard. Like, we can't really get to wisdom directly. Although it's good to meditate, but we won't get there easily. It's a very hard path, and there's actually a lot of pitfalls in it. But we can't go wrong by cultivating love and compassion. And if we cultivate love and compassion, you know, progressively, then it naturally leads to wisdom. Wisdom comes naturally after that. So it's fine. That's what this, you know, this text is mostly, just like the Great Path of Awakening, mostly focused on relative bodhicitta, on the cultivation of love and compassion, although they both have sections specifically about ultimate bodhicitta, because we also need, you know, we need to know what we're working towards. We need some experience of it. So does anybody have any questions or comments before we go into the commentaries today? So, Marilyn, I will unmute you.
Patrick said something interesting this morning about why it seems to be set up perhaps as a zero-sum gain. I mean, I don't know whether you said, but you want to say what you meant? That why do we have to give, why do we lose our happiness? You put it that way. You know, the only way to do this is to give away your happiness. And of course, Ken MacLeod says, in fact, this isn't about happiness.
Mm-hmm, right.
We can give away our happiness and still have happiness.
Do we feel like we're giving away our happiness? Like, are we bereft of happiness now? It's an excellent question. It's an excellent question. I don't think we're, first of all, our happiness is inexhaustible, because the happiness that is allowing us to do this practice is the happiness of our Buddha nature, which is limitless. It's limitless happiness. It's not a fixed quantity of happiness that we have, and that by giving it away, it diminishes our happiness. It actually increases our happiness. And I think that if we practice it, you know, if we apply ourselves to the practice, we do notice that over time. Something else went through my mind to say about it, but I think I'm just had a crazy couple of weeks and it's gone. But Patrick.
Well, the word because of this, to genuinely trade.
Yeah.
Either genuinely share.
No, it's not expressed that way. And I'm just writing down my thought that I lost a minute ago, because it will really help. So it's always expressed that we give. How is it said in the verse? It's to exchange our happiness for others' suffering. But this was particularly well expressed by Tim Olmsted when Pema Chodron taught last year at Omega the 37 practices, and he led us in some meditations. And I actually probably have it in this folder. Like what he said. Yeah, I do. Right. So I'll use his words, but I've actually run across this now in other commentaries, particularly in I think it's in Geshe Jampa Tegchok says the same thing. But he says something really helpful as he introduced the meditation of taking and sending in this workshop. I know it's here. Okay, it's like one little paragraph. So he says, mind training has a threefold arc or progression of training. First, to equalize oneself with others. Second, to exchange oneself for others. And third, to put others before oneself. So again, we're talking about training our own mind. Like, this is not an actual transaction that's taking place, that we actually even have the capacity to give away our happiness and take on somebody else's suffering. What we're training our mind at the first level to do is just to think of others as equally important as ourselves. Like, because of our innate ego clinging, like, our reflex is team I, you know, it's like to think of ourselves first. However much we may overcome that in our actual daily life, that's our reflex. So we're working to change that reflex to actually see other beings as equally important as ourselves. So as much as we want ourselves to be happy, we want them to have that same level of happiness. And then once we've done that, and it's a natural progression, we don't have to divide it up. But right now, that's what's happening, is we're actually starting to think of others along with ourselves. And then the next phase of that practice is that we can really exchange ourselves for others, like really put ourselves in the other person's shoes. Like, really, you know, it's hard to like say that otherwise, but so equalizing oneself with others is like, they're still there and you're still here. Like, they still have what they have, you still have what you have. But then when we exchange ourselves for others, we really aspire to take on like whatever bad stuff they have and to give them whatever good stuff we have. And it could be materially, like give them the last piece of pie, give them the, you know, the last seat, whatever it is. And to do it in a joyful, heartfelt way, that's like where the practice leads, I think. And then at the real bodhisattva level, we put others before ourselves. But by seeing this as in those three steps, it takes the pressure off. Like, we're going to fail all the time at putting others really first and really being willing to take on their, you know, their suffering and give them our happiness. At the end, it seems like that's really the way it is. So now if somebody, I don't know, lost all their money, you know, if somebody was like, you know, lost everything in a hurricane, maybe our aspiration would be just to help to bring them back up to our level. You know, we're not giving away our house to them, but we're just trying to help them have the same house back that we have. So we can help them materially to do that. And then, but when you're a real bodhisattva, like, there's like the progression. And then by the end, you would give them your house. You would do that because you're a bodhisattva. I mean, just the same way there are stories of great bodhisattvas giving away their limbs and even cutting off their own head, giving up their life for the starving tigress, or, you know, or whoever, the person who demands that they cut off their arm for them. So any further questions or comments on that, Patrick? Any further exploration of that?
Well, it seems like other ways to describe it would be empathy or generosity.
Mm-hmm. Those are part of, this goes beyond, I think, empathy and generosity as a practice. Like, if you were to take the practice literally, I think it's even beyond. But yeah, they're all part of it. Definitely. This is an act of generosity, definitely, to give away our happiness and take somebody else's suffering. That's generous. And it's also empathy. We do it because we feel with them, compassion. We feel with them. We feel their suffering with them. So yeah, I think those are good words to describe it too. Anything further?
I don't know. No.
Okay, good discussion. I mean, I don't think any question is ever fully answered, but I think it's good to explore these questions together. John, is that you? Did you want to say something? Okay, I'm on mute.
Yeah, so you said that nothing's really gained or lost when you do this exercise. Then how is it referred to as action?
I have not seen an explanation of that. This is actually the first time I've ever encountered it, to know that I'm encountering it, that taking and sending is considered action bodhicitta rather than aspiration bodhicitta. But all the commentaries agree on that. So I think it's the action of actually training our mind, as opposed to just having a wish. Like, this is beyond having a wish. So I think it's almost like a bridge between the two, but it's classified as action bodhicitta because we're taking an action, which is, it's a mental action. But as we know from the 10 unvirtuous actions, 3 of the 10 unvirtuous actions are mental actions: covetousness, ill will, and wrong view. So thoughts are considered an action. So that's my understanding of it. That's my interpretation. It's literally classified as action bodhicitta in the commentaries. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay.
I have one comment about the zero-sum game that we were that was mentioned. And I think an analogy might be, or could be, that of energy. Or like, I do Tai Chi, so you're always building that energy, but you also want to release that. You don't want to hold it. You want to get rid of it and keep it flowing. Mm-hmm. So is it something along that line, or am I totally off base there?
No, I think it's a good analogy. I think there are good analogies. They're never going to be like 100%. Like, no analogy for like nature of mind, for example, is ever really the nature of mind. But I think that's a very good analogy. It is a flow, and I think that's a really important point. It's the way that like Kala Rinpoche, for example, answered it. It's in one of his books. Like that somebody asks him, you know, like this is really common when people first learn it, like, you know, really beginner students first learn taking and sending, they're kind of horrified because they think they're going to get sick. Like if you taking and sending for someone who has cancer, what if you get cancer? And what Kala Rinpoche said was, you should think, oh, good, it works. And I think it's Ken MacLeod who ends his commentary on this particular verse saying, if you could really do this, wouldn't you? Like, wouldn't you take their suffering away? But we're not there yet because we're not equalized yet. You know, we're still very reflexively beyond our control, focused on ourselves. And I think it would be very hard for us now to really take somebody else's cancer, even knowing it would free them from it. It's really hard to be in that mindset. That's what we're cultivating, is that mindset, like that everybody's should equally not have cancer as us. Like however much we should not have cancer, they should not have cancer either. And so we're still cultivating like an intention here, but it's an action of mind to actually visualize it happening. But anyway, so people do get that. And the other way that it's answered, besides Kala Rinpoche's answer, is, don't worry, it's not really happening. You don't have the ability to do it yet. You're just training your mind.
Dalama?
So, yes.
Mark.
Mark, yeah.
I've been reading some stuff, getting prepared for this, and I've seen it in a couple of different places that it's not a literal thing. It's really a practice.
Yeah.
It leads you to a good... One of my teachers said, just be satisfied that you're being led to greener pastures.
Yeah. Yeah.
But making it literally can actually be a real obstacle, you know.
Yeah, for us. And that's why the teachers answer the way that they do. Like, don't worry, you can't really do this. It's just like a right. Visualization. And if you really get sick, then you really did it. And it's a really good thing to do. But it is said that great, you know, really realized people can actually do it. Like there's the story of, I think it's a sangha, you know, I'm not 100% sure. No, that doesn't seem quite right. But anyway, one of the great teachers was teaching some students like in a room, and outside somebody threw a rock at a dog. Remember that story? Somebody threw a rock at a dog, and the teacher fell over in pain, and he had a bruise on his back, and he had actually, you know, known that the thing was happening, and he took it away from the dog. So it's said that at a certain level, like really, really high level, you can actually do it, and people may be doing it for us. Great bodhisattvas might be doing it for us. We might be feeling a lot less pain right now than, you know, than we should be, because there's so many benevolent beings looking out for us, and I believe that to be true.
There's a story about.
Oh, go ahead.
A story about Dingo Kensei, where he, when he would come to a village, all the hunters would hide their guns because he could just kind of blow into them and they wouldn't work anymore.
Yes, yes. So that's what we're cultivating. Like right now it's baby steps, but we're cultivating that. Like, what if we really could do it? Wouldn't we, as Ken McLeod says, or, oh good, it's working. As Kala Rinpoche says, it'll be a long time. And the thing is, by the time you get there, it's like, it's not a problem. It's like when my daughter was, she went to half day kindergarten in Wappingers Falls, at the school next to the monastery. And the next, like as that year came to an end, she was like, first grade is full day. And she was like, you know, I'm really scared. And I said, you're going to be like a lot older when you have to get on the bus and be there the whole day. And sure enough, it was fine, more or less, you know. So we're growing into something, and it's not going to be forced, and we're not going to be who we are now. Like when we can take on the pain of a dog being hit by a rock or a car or whatever, we're going to be like our ability, our capacity, our wisdom and compassion will be at that level. So it's not going to hurt because our ego is not going to be involved. Right now, we still got the ego to tend to. Yes, Valerie, I'm unmuting you. Trying to unmute you. Yeah.
Our politics in this this base, it is so aggressively hurtful, I would say.
What are you talking about?
All these people that support Trump.
Okay, well, I think you have to be very careful because we don't know who those people are. We want to be...
Well, look at, all right, the Alabama election, that they elected this really terrible man, right? This guy.
Are we talking about our election?
Well, the Alabama election. This guy's, just very bad. Are these people just not letting go of their ego, that they're so not seeing what all this turns into? I think
it's our ego too that's judging them. So we have to be very, we want to take and send for everybody. And we want to recognize that our opinions and judgments are our opinions and judgments. I'm not saying you're wrong, but I'm also saying that we can't ultimately judge anybody else. We don't have the wisdom to really know the outcome of things or to know people's motivations. We're not in their shoes. So that's what you see a lot of, I mean, on Facebook, for example. You know, you just see people who are so entrenched that they think that their opinion and their judgment is reality, and it really upsets them that somebody else sees things completely differently. And so it becomes impossible to do that exchange, like to equalize or exchange self for other, because we're busy like judging the person. I don't know if this is helping at all answer the question.
Well, I
have an answer for like why people do what they do or what they see. That answer I don't have, but I feel like everybody sees things the way that they can. Like every one of us does the best we can to see as big a picture as we can. And the fact is, because of relative reality, we can see it very, very differently. I don't ascribe like evil motive to people. I think everybody's just doing the best they can, and we just have disagreements about what that best is. And I'm not sure that the way I think things should be done would necessarily result only in benefit to other people either, because I don't have that wisdom. Namdak? Whoops, I can't hear you, Namdak. We're not getting sound from you. I'm sorry, can you type it? Oh. Can't hear your voice. We got a little static. Can you type what you wanted to say? Okay. Okay. You're getting some sound. You want to try speaking one more time? No, didn't get it. So sorry. Okay, anybody else have something to add? Valerie, did you want to say anything else?
Well, I mean, even this, the NFL players' protest is getting all whipped up into disrespect for the flag, and you know, their message is completely co-opted. I mean, these people that have suffered so much, and it just seems like there's a segment of the population that doesn't want to even acknowledge that.
Yeah. But again, we're looking at very different perspectives. There are very different perspectives on it. And ultimately, I don't think any perspective is 100% right, because none of us sees the whole picture. So I don't want to get into politics, because, you know, we don't all agree on everything. I don't have a judgment to offer on this. Just, I think we have to do taking and sending for both sides, for everybody. Marilyn, I think I saw you waving. Okay, what's going on here? I can't hear you, but you're unmuted. There you are. Okay.
All I wanted to say is that this is a perfect example of what to use when you're practicing Tonglen, is if you have a strong aversion to a politician, for example, then that's a great person to practice on, you know, taking and sending with. I mean, that's what I do. I live in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Even amongst, I mean, you know, again, I don't want to go too much into politics, but even amongst people who, you know, don't like our current government, they're fighting with each other too. You know, there's the far progressive end and there's the centrist end, and there's like a lot of like bad feelings there too. It's like, and it just keeps, it's like a fractal, you know, it just keeps getting, you can keep refining it further to very small disagreements, but we get entrenched. I mean, I think it's an excellent thing to bring up, Valerie. I'm not getting the answer that you were hoping I would be able to help with, because I don't think I can.
No, I'm just really trying to, you know, get a little insight into, you know, this thing that's happening.
Yeah, I don't think we can figure it out. I mean, I think that's the message of the Buddha. We can't figure stuff out. Like, we can never make relative reality make sense. So that's why we have these practices. We have the practice of just opening your mind as wide as possible, you know, in a non-judgmental way, and that's awareness. And we have the practice of love and compassion, which is like, no matter how much, no matter what we think of other people, even Hitler, you do taking and sending for them. He's going to have tremendous suffering, Hitler. He's been having it for many years now, as far as the Buddha's teachings go. But we, our job, our one job as a bodhisattva, is to love, have love and compassion for everybody, whether we agree with them or disagree with them, even people that are doing harm, that we are quite sure are doing harm. There's not much question about Hitler. Although there is another point of view that says, you know, that's the right way to go. I mean, he wasn't like operating completely on his own. Even those people, our job is taking and sending. Our job is not, I mean, we may in some ways feel that we can get involved politically and that there are things we can do. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. If you have a strong feeling about it, then there's things we can do. But our job as bodhisattvas and as Dharma practitioners is we have love and compassion for everybody. I mean, others first. You know, even people we hate, we have to do that. Even people who are screaming in our face at this very moment, our reflex should be taking and sending, even as we deal with the situation, however we need to deal with it. So this is really important. It's an excellent, thank you, Valerie. It's such an excellent illustration of why this is debated with our practice. We need to develop this as a reflex. Like, no matter what's happening or what our ego thinks of somebody else, taking and sending is their job.
Lama?
Yes, Namdok, yes, we can hear you.
I unplugged my speakers. I was having trouble hearing you, so I plugged my speakers in, and now apparently when my speakers are plugged in, I can't speak to you.
Yeah.
My question is, are we bodhisattvas or are we aspiring bodhisattvas?
There's different definitions, but I think generally our contemporary teachers at least tell us that once we have developed the bodhisattva intention, then we are bodhisattvas. There's another point of view, a more technical point of view, that you're not technically a bodhisattva till you get to the first bhumi, till you have that realization. And that realization is seeing things the way they are, seeing the emptiness, which is exactly what we're talking about, the emptiness of all phenomena, that there's no right way to see things. It doesn't exist. The only right way to see things is love and compassion. like at our level, that's the best we can do. Because I used to think, even like as a longtime practicing Buddhist, that if you could take everybody's point of view about any particular thing and put it together, you get like a whole thing. Like you just take how everybody sees it and you would get a clear picture. And now I think you wouldn't. You still just have a jumble of things. Relative reality never adds up to ultimate reality. It's imbued with you know, they're together, they're imbued with each other. But you can never, as Sita Rinpoche said, there's no relative ultimate and there's no ultimate relative. You got the relative things and then you got the knowledge that the ultimate reality underlies everything. And that's all. And so our job is simply to practice the Dharma. And it doesn't keep us from dealing with things in more material ways, like, you know, working in a phone bank for a candidate or feeding, you know, poor people, doing Meals on Wheels, whatever we can do for people. But our job as bodhisattvas or aspiring bodhisattvas, however you want to frame that, is no matter what we think of somebody and no matter what they're doing, even if it's terribly harmful or we think it's terribly harmful, our only job as Dharma practitioners is to focus on just send them love and compassion while we're doing whatever we have to do to prevent harm or clean up harm or whatever. Anybody else have a comment? Yes, Richard, I'm going to unmute you.
I'm just thinking that the main thing, the problem with like what Valerie was having and other people, myself included, is that we see ourselves as right. And as long as we start with that assumption, we're not going to like anything that's different.
Yeah.
And we don't know. We have no idea if we're right or not. I mean, it's like when I try to save a bug and I end up killing it.
Yeah.
You
know,
you can't start with the assumption that what you think is right.
Yeah.
It's an opinion.
Yeah.
And as long as you let go of that, then you can work with things.
Once you recognize that everything you think is an opinion, like there's
right.
Not any facts out there to be had. It's all somebody's point of view.
Right.
And that's what I meant by like no ultimate relative. Like you put it all together and it still doesn't add up.
Yeah.
So thank you, Rich. I think that's a really, really helpful way to put it.
Can I throw one thing in here?
Yes, is that Mark?
Yeah.
There is a
Jataka tale, I guess. It's one of the Buddha's previous incarnations. And he was on a boat and he recognized that the captain was going to kill everybody on the boat. Yeah. And so he threw the captain overboard, and the rest of the people on the boat were saved. So,
yeah, he could see at that point he was so realized already that he could see the outcome of the action. We would need to be very careful about taking such a step. Although I can't say there would never be a situation where it wasn't clear enough. That to save other people, you might have to harm someone, but we would need to be extremely careful about applying that.
Sure, I agree. There is a case where.
Oh yeah, yeah. When you're a Buddha, or when you're almost a Buddha, then yeah, you're probably not going to make mistakes. But as Richard said, sometimes when we're trying to save a bug, we kill the bug. I don't think like the Buddha in that lifetime would have, you know, had that kind of an accident. But thank you for sharing that. That's a really good thing to keep in mind. All right, Chet, you're unmuted. Oops, Chet, I can't hear you talking. There must be something, you have some impediment to your sound coming to us.
He's showing.
He's
okay.
What?
How about now?
Oh, yes, we got you.
I had to actually unmute myself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I unmuted you, but anyway.
Aren't we really talking about conditioned existence? This is really what conditioned existence is. These are all different forms of samsara that we're talking about. I mean, to be upset about someone else's political opinion is your own suffering. Mm-hmm. And it's because we don't see we don't see the ultimate reality. So we see our own relative reality, which causes us to suffer. In the same way that the people who have these other belief systems, they suffer on their own, but they just suffer in a different way. But You know, they look at us, I mean, I'll say us, I'll take us all in the same category, and they go, this is suffering. These other people are just awful. So we're all in the same,
Yes, yes, it's true.
We're all in the same realm at the same time.
And yet, as I think Valerie was trying to point out, and Mark also, sometimes somebody's doing something that really hurts somebody. Like, somebody's really getting hurt out of the situation. Again, sometimes it's our interpretation of it, and it's really hard to know, and that's why it's called confusion. Like, we don't see things in a clear way, but if you really see somebody hurting somebody, then you intervene. You know, I think you have to intervene. Maybe that's voting for another person, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, or getting in between two people who are fighting, or whatever it is we can do, but always practicing our one job, which is love and compassion for everybody. So everybody's had great comments. Anybody else have anything to add? All right, then I'm going to remute everybody, and we'll go on to the commentaries. But if anybody has anything to say, please unmute yourself or let me know. And I might not see you right away, so you might have to get. Let me go back to mute. Okay, so you're all muted again. And we're going to look at the commentaries. I don't know if we'll get as far as I want to. And I would like to have the option to do another week on this verse if we need to, because there is so much. And it's just so, I see Marilyn is nodding. You know, we don't have to be in a rush. And most of the verses we don't need more than 1 week on. But, this verse is just so foundational and worth discussing. I mean, I think we need to take our time, you know, and everybody ask your questions and make your comments and share your thoughts and your feelings about it, and that helps all of us to really explore it. So we're going to look at a little bit more of Dingo Chense Rinpoche. I'm trying to see where we left off. Okay, the time. Okay. Okay, I think we got to page 111. I think so. If anybody knows that we went further than that, speak up now. it's right after he has some verses quoted from Shantideva, which we're actually going to look at later, not right now. So he says, the exchange of self and others can also be used as a way of dealing with your negative emotions. If you allow the negative emotions to express themselves in the ordinary way, you cannot hope to progress on the path. That means if, like, we get angry and we don't try to apply a remedy, we just allow ourselves to go with our, you know, our anger or our desire. We don't try to intervene with any remedies. We just let them carry us away. Then we can't hope to progress on the path. In the sutras, there are many instructions on how to deal with the emotions by rejecting them. But here we consider how to work with them through compassion and take desire as an example. And I think this is going to speak to a question that John asked last week. So he says, desire is, which was about how to work with your own emotions within the context of Tonglen, taking and sending. So desire is the compulsive attraction and attachment we feel toward a person or an object. We all know what that feels like. Start by considering. So this is almost like a meditation here. Let's do this as a meditation. So we'll just get back into our meditative frame of mind. And just really let this be vivid and really do this. So start by considering, okay, so well, this is still thinking. Start by considering that if you tame your own desire, you will be able to reach enlightenment in order to best help beings and to establish them all in Buddhahood. So that is actually, that's a good explanation, a good capsule summary of why verse 11 is considered action bodhicitta, which is similar to what I said, but of course I'd read this. That to really help people, we have to start with ourselves. We have to tame our own mind first. And mind training and taking and sending is training our own mind to be able to really help others. So now, in our meditative frame of mind, think about someone you do not like. Anyone, personal connection, political, anything. Just bring them to mind. They are with you. Arousing great compassion for that person, add all his desires to your own. So again, it looks like we started out by thinking of some, maybe thinking, just feeling that feeling, like touching in with that feeling of really wanting something. And then we bring to mind somebody that we really don't like. And arousing great compassion for that person, add all of that person's desires to your own, and think that as you take that person's desire away, that person becomes free of desire. So you could do it as taking it and sending, breathing in their desire and just taking it into whatever desire you're feeling. And then progressively all beings' desires, whether manifest or latent, upon yourself. And as you do so, think that all beings become free from desire and achieve enlightenment. This is the way to meditate on taking negative emotions according to relative truth. So I'm going to just pull out my great path of awakening here, because this is exactly one of the slogans. This is the post-meditation slogan. Oh, I've got the wrong. Where is it? Oh, I need to have it in my pile. I'll just use the old translation. It's the post-meditation slogan for taking and sending itself. So post-meditation, again, means anytime you're not meditating, sometimes also translated as between sessions. It's in our daily life. So this is actually how we can apply taking and sending in our daily life. It's right after the slogan, train in taking and sending alternately, put them on the breath. So post-meditation, the slogan is three objects, three poisons, three seeds of virtue, which is very cryptic. And he explains what it means. But it just means that whenever, like, so you see an object and you have a reaction to it, either desire or anger, aversion, you want it or you want it gone, you can turn that into a seed of virtue. So for every object, there's an emotion, and for every, you know, conjunction of those two things, we can turn that into virtue. And how can we do that? We can turn that into a positive thing when we feel angry towards somebody, or we feel like we have to have this thing and we feel frustrated. So he says, recognize these poisons as soon as they arise. This is Zhong Gong Hong Chul. And then, for example, when attachment arises, think, may every bit of every sentient being's attachment be contained in this attachment of mine. May all sentient beings have to see the virtue of being free of attachment. May this attachment of mine contain all of their disturbing emotions. And until they attain Buddhahood, may they be free of such disturbing emotions. And he says, aversion and other emotions are used in practice by working with them the same way. Thus, the three poisons become three limitless seeds of virtue. So this is how we can work. So there's two ways, in a way, to work with taking and sending about our own emotions. And one is to do the formal practice. When we're doing formal practice, we can take ourselves, our own suffering as the object, and breathe in our own suffering and breathe out happiness to ourselves. That's the formal practice way to do it. But in daily life, whenever something makes us angry or makes us want it or makes us jealous or whatever, then instead of trying to like get rid of that emotion, we use it to take on that emotion, like in everybody else, to take that emotion away from everybody else. May every being's anger be collected into this anger that I'm feeling right now. May my anger take it away from all of them, and may they be free of anger and just have happiness. So that's how we can, that's another way to apply taking and sending in our life. And if only we could remember to do that. Yes, Patrick, I'm unmuting you. Yep.
In the last few years, I've had experiences in all kinds of hospital settings. And I thought that it would be a good idea for me to do Tonglen there, in MRI tubes and things like that, where there had been and radiation treatment rooms, and where there had been a lot of other people, you know, the room was full of suffering.
Yeah.
And I was advised that it would cause me trouble to do it that way, but it would be better for me to visualize a medicine Buddha in the room, and then medicine Buddha would be working for me as well as all the other energies that were in the room.
And yeah.
Wouldn't amount to taking on acknowledging that I'm suffering also, and let the Yidam do it.
Yeah. Right? Yes. I think it's another way. I think you could classify that under mind training. You know, mind training, as Tim Olmsted said, it's the first step of it is equalizing self with other. So if you're invoking Medicine Buddha for yourself, invoke it for everybody else. I think that's it fits into the same category. It doesn't have to be an exchange where you give up the Medicine Buddha for yourself and only send, you know, Medicine Buddha to other beings. Here we're just remembering other beings and thinking they're just as important as I am. They want to be free of this illness just as much as I do. And that's the crux of it right there, is just to remember it. Did I see somebody else waving? Okay. All right, so we'll continue. So basically, this is very similar in a way. Is it exactly the same? Not exactly the same. When Lama Norla taught mind training a few years back, he gave instructions for what to do at the time of death. This is in point 5 of mind training, which is what to do when you're alive and what to do when you're dying. And he said, when your mind is calm, like when you're on your deathbed, you're really dying, if your mind is calm, just rest in awareness. But when an emotion arises, do taking and sending. And so anything that disturbs your mind, you apply a more active meditation to. And I think this is the same. Like when we're sitting in formal meditation and everything is calm around us, we can just rest our mind and we can do taking and sending like completely unobstructed. But when our mind is inhabited by an emotional affliction, then we use that. We don't try to go to calm mind. This is just another way we can approach it. We use that and we say, I can use this anger to take on the anger of everybody and free them from it. And it's, again, it's just mind training. It's an attitude that we're developing that then helps us. You know, if we're actually in a real situation with somebody, that will come up. We'll think, I want them to be happy just as much as I want myself to be happy. So let me take their anger. Like I'm feeling angry at them, they're angry at me, let me take their anger into myself. And it just helps you deal with the situation, even if they stay angry, which they probably will. But then sometimes their anger is based on your anger coming back at them. And if that disappears and you instead are more focused on love and compassion, even as you might be feeling some frustration or anger, they're going to feel that. Like that changes the dynamic of that situation. And it may not resolve it right then, but you're partly in control of the dynamic of the whole situation. Like whatever it is, how your mind is affects how other people's minds are. And when I explain this to people, sometimes they say, really? And I go, okay, you're in a room with some other people, you're just hanging out, and a really angry person walks in and they don't say anything and they don't do anything, but you can tell that they're really angry, and it changes the temperature of the room. It just changes like the relaxed atmosphere of the room. So it works in reverse too. You walk into an angry room, but you're completely calm and you're just sending love out to everybody. And it has an effect. It may not solve it, you know, but it has an effect. And I think it spreads. So it's like when I've been upset and somebody has like just been calm in the face of that, then my upsetness has nowhere to go. It doesn't get exacerbated. It doesn't get strengthened and reinforced. And it just, I can let go of it and just kind of calm down. So that's that practice. And, you know, mark this in your book or something, because do this practice, and not just words on a page, but really try to do this. Tattoo it on your arm. You're going to have so many tattoos by the time this class is finished. Whatever it takes to remember it. Richard, I'm going to unmute you. Oops, there we go.
I'm just thinking that there have been people in my life where I would have taken their suffering really.
Yeah.
And I know it.
I know it too, Richard. I know some people.
I figure you do too. But yeah. Is that attachment or is that some form of bodhicitta?
I can answer that question because I have heard someone answer that question really brilliantly. It might have been Lama Karma Samten, was asked that question, like, how do you tell when it's love and how do you tell when it's attachment? And he said, attachment is when it's about making you happy, and love is about making the other person happy. So in a relationship with somebody, if your concern is making them happy, that's love. And if your concern is that they make you happy, then that's attachment. And we all have like proportions, you know, it's proportionate. Yeah, Richard, anything else?
Well, I was just thinking, then you could think of those people and think other people are just like them.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want to suffer any more than that person. Yeah. In a way, but I mean, my main question was about attachment or love.
Yeah.
Because honestly, I would have taken suffering on myself, and I know it.
Yeah. And I think
so I also know it doesn't work.
Exactly. It doesn't work for but did you read Cave in the Snow, Tenzin Palmo's biography? Where she tells a story at the beginning of the book, like she sort of knew she was a Buddhist, but she didn't know what a Buddhist was. She found out like later when she ran across a book about it. But she tells a story about her mother, like she some hot water or soup or something was poured on her when she was really young, like 2 years old. And she said she never had any aftermath from it. And she feels that her mother took that on. Her mother saw it happening and her wish was so strong that it never caused Tenzin Palmo pain. Well, I think maybe, I'm not saying your love wasn't strong enough, Richard. I think that was just some
situation. No, I just meant it's nothing. It's not any fear in doing, taking, and sending because if I could have made it work in those situations, it would have.
You would have totally done it. Just like a parent would jump in front of a speeding car to save their child.
That's what
thinking about it. Like, no question you would do that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's love. I don't think that's attachment.
Yeah, that's not attachment because you're giving up. You'd give up your happiness for that person. You're not looking to them to make you happy and fulfill you in some way. You're just, it's totally going the other way. And that's the bodhisattva. Uh-huh. You know, it becomes true bodhisattva when what we want to do is free them from suffering. You know, free them from samsara.
Right.
But that's, you know, that's pretty close to bodhisattva. It's like, that's a kind of selflessness. We probably all have somebody in our life that we can really relate to that story. But I know that you do, Richard, because I can think of some people that you would definitely give up your life for.
Yeah.
Okay, anybody else have a comment? So we'll go a little bit further. We are going to run out of time, and there are some other resources I'd like to bring in. So we're going to just try to finish up Dingo Chensei this week. And we'll continue next week, because I think this is really rich, you know, field for discussion and practice and exploration. So that's the meditation that he gives us. And again, write it down somewhere, put it on an index card, put it on your, you know, a post-it note on your bathroom mirror, whatever. Like, whenever I feel anger or desire or jealousy or confusion, my first reflex is going to be make all of the anger of all beings be collected in mine and made to be free of it. And just having that thought trains your mind. Doesn't seem like it does anything, but simply having the recollection to do that is the main thing. So that here's the other way that you can deal with. So he's now giving us the absolute bodhicitta way to deal with strong emotions. That's the relative bodhicitta way. So he says to meditate according to absolute truth or ultimate truth, arousing yourself an overwhelming feeling of desire. So if we can, again, we'll kind of meditate a little bit or contemplate this by bringing to mind something that we have really wanted. Maybe there's something now, but something we've really wanted or wanted to happen. And the feeling of that, like not knowing if we're going to get it. And fuel it by adding the desires of all beings. So then think all beings have had the same feeling of desire. So now it fills the whole universe. He says to make a great mountain of desire. Then look right into it. So this is just like looking back at the nature of our mind. We're going to look at the nature of our emotions. And he says, if we look right at the emotion, just look at it without judgment, without thinking about it or analyzing it, we will see that desire is nothing but thoughts. It appears in your mind, but it does not itself have even the tiniest particle of independent existence. And when you turn the mind inward to look at itself, you become aware that the mind too is without any inherent existence in either past, present, or future. Imagine how liberating that is when it comes to you as an insight, like when you really get that. And we all get that sometimes. Wow. The nature of the mind is as insubstantial as the sky. So this is the bottom of page 11 and the top of page 112. This is a really powerful and essential meditation we can do in our life. And it's a key to how we can deal with any emotional affliction that arises in our mind. So become very familiar with this and it will help. So he says, he goes on to say, still on page 112, as you practice this core practice of the Bodhisattva path, you should try to see very vividly all your happiness going to others and all their sufferings coming to you. And that's like the zero-sum game that Marilyn and Patrick were talking about. This is how we think of it, but it's not exactly what's happening. Think that it is actually happening, he says. Of all the practices of the Bodhisattvas, this is the most essential. Or as I said at the beginning of the class today, this is the main tool in our Bodhisattva toolbox. This is our one job as a Bodhisattva. He says, there is no obstacle that can disrupt it. Not only will it help others, but it will bring you to enlightenment too. So how will it help others if it doesn't really work? Well, I think, as I was saying before, it changes the dynamic, like with another person, when that's where your mind is going. Instead of going to retaliation, it's going to, how can I breathe in this person's suffering? Like, this person is suffering. They're tormenting me right now, but it's coming from their suffering. So I'm going to breathe in whatever suffering they have. I'm going to breathe out whatever happiness I have. And I'm not going to let my mind get derailed into retaliatory anger. So that's how it helps others at this point in our mind training. It doesn't really have a physical material effect, but it changes the dynamic and gives their mind a lot more space to work with. So then he tells some stories, and we're not going to have time to look at those, but they're worth reading. I did want to read the one about Guru Rinpoche, though, because we chant that practice in Chenrezig, and this is a good explanation of why we do, in case you ever wonder. So it's on page 113. The great master Padmasambhava Guru Rinpoche is an emanation of Avalokiteshvara Chenrezig and the very embodiment of compassion. If he's Chenrezig, he's compassion. His dedication to others is so potent that even now, in this degenerate age, simply to remember him or invoke his name instantly cuts through obstacles, adverse circumstances, and evil influences, rendering them powerless, and brings the blessings of his body, speech, and mind. When Guru Rinpoche arrived in Tibet, he subdued all the negative forces, such as the 12 sisters, the 21 Upasakas, and many others who were creating obstacles to the establishment of Dharma. And here's the key sentence. He was able to do so not because he was motivated by anger, but by the power of his compassion and bodhicitta. Oh, bye, Fanny. I'm glad you have some work. Glad you could be with us today. Great to see you. Love you, Fanny. All right, so that sentence, it says the exact thing. Like, we're dealing with so many things now in our culture that sometimes we feel like there's no way to meet this force of anger and harm except with anger and harm. But that's not what Guru Rinpoche did. He was able to subdue all of these negative forces, not through anger, but by the power of his compassion and bodhicitta. It's very powerful. And again, we start on a very small scale, like we're having a disagreement with somebody and we shift our mind to love and compassion, to taking and sending, instead of, like, we can let go of the anger and change our focus. And by doing that, like, our anger is never going to accomplish the thing, right? It's just like all the Facebook arguments. It's just like they're just going to keep hitting each other because everybody's entrenched in their point of view. So we're giving up our point of view. And if you've read my thing, my post in the blog on 18 ways to catch ego clinging in the act, this is one of them, like wanting to be right. That is ego clinging. And in that moment, when you recognize that, you can step back from ego clinging and you can send love and compassion instead. You can react from your Buddha nature instead of reacting from your ego. But you got to recognize it first, and that's the job we have. But just a reinforcement here that anger is never helpful. There's no use for it. That is the Buddha's teaching. There is no constructive aspect to anger. So we want to apply remedies when we're angry and then act from love and compassion. And we can act forcefully from love and compassion. It's just about what is in our mind. We're not necessarily acting differently, but it's about what our mind is. And that's how we can have a peaceful mind and have that patience that's described in Ornament of Precious Liberation. Our mind does not need to be disturbed by anything at all. We can still do what we need to do, take whatever action we need to take. So to wrap this up, he says the exchange of, oh, here's where it was, the same thing that Tim Olmsted said, it's on page 114. The exchange of yourself and others can be approached step by step. Tim Olmsted probably read it here, because this is one of the resources they were using. The first stage is to see yourself and others as equally important. Others want to be happy and want not to suffer just as you do. So you should wish happiness for others in the same way that you wish it for yourself, and wish that they may avoid suffering just as you do. So you could think, I want beings to be as happy as I am. So I'm just going to take away enough suffering and give enough happiness that we could both be equally happy. The second stage is the exchange of yourself and others. You wish that others may have your happiness and that you may take their suffering. There's the zero sum, I guess. And then there's a third stage, which is to cherish others more than yourself, like the great bodhisattvas who, meeting a blind person, would have no hesitation in giving him their own eyes. At that point, all selfish preoccupation has completely disappeared, and you are solely concerned with the welfare of others. Keep right on with this practice until that becomes a reality. So we don't expect too much of ourselves. It's practice, practice, practice. You know, we have to look at it that way. We're not great bodhisattvas yet, so we can't do it, and it's going to hurt sometimes to, like, let go of the anger and try to do taking and sending for the person, you know, whatever it is. It's just practice, but it has a result, ultimately. So we have to keep at it. I'm going to skip over some things. Oh, yes, there's some lovely things in here. Just to go to the end, because we are at 228 right now, which is probably really 229. So as a beginner, right? As a beginner, well, let's start at the beginning of the paragraph. To have overflowing love and unbearable compassion for all beings, therefore, is the best way to fulfill the wishes of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Our one job, overflowing love and unbearable compassion for all beings. As a beginner, you may not be able to help beings outwardly very much, but you should meditate constantly on love and compassion until your whole being is imbued with them. The training of exchanging suffering and happiness is something to practice not just for one session or for one day, but over the months, days, months, and years until the bodhicitta fully blooms from within you. You may ask yourselves, as I did, why does he say the bodhicitta? Like, why does he keep saying the bodhicitta? It's because this book was actually translated mainly by Mathieu Ricard, French guy. So they always say the in front of every name. So that's the reason, and I just ignore it. So he says, the core text of the teachings on bodhicitta is Shantideva's The Way of the Bodhisattva. When the great yogi Patril Rinpoche was studying it, he did not learn more than two or three verses a day because he was meditating on them and integrating their meaning thoroughly. I'm impressed he was learning one or two verses a day. Like, that's presented as kind of a minimum here to allow himself plenty of time to meditate. But remember, he was a full-time monk and dog student. So he probably had a job in the kitchen or something, but he had a lot of time to do this, and we may not. He was constantly struck by how wonderful and profound a teaching it was, and he felt sad each time he reached the end of the text. He always had it with him until the end of his life. And that is a perfect way to end not only Dingo Chenzi's commentary, but this class, because we're going to start with Shantideva next week. We're going to look at how Shantideva presents this, the motivation of a bodhisattva. And also, if you read the verses, and I put what they are on the post in the class notes, like which verses we're going to look at, it's not only the ones that Dingo Chenzi shares with us that are about, like, embody the motivation of a bodhisattva, but it's also, you'll recognize some of those verses. I'm actually not going to give it away, but you're going to recognize some of those verses and go, oh, so that's where that comes from. So you're welcome to preview those Shantideva verses. We're also going to look at the Bible, which, I mean, this is also Christianity, right? It's the teachings of Jesus Christ. It's, you know, do unto others and put others first and so on and so forth. So we're going to look at one way that's expressed in the Bible, which I think is very beautiful. And also Ken MacLeod has a really nice chapter, and we'll do all of that next week. Yes, Namdak. Oh, we can't hear you again, Namdak. Unplug your speaker. Oh, nope, still can't hear you. Try it again. Okay, it's showing you. Okay, something's funny is happening here. Okay, you should be able to talk now. Try it now. No, try it now, Namdak. I think I got you unmuted. Okay. All right. I think I'm having some trouble with my mute button here because I'm unmuting and it says mute. That, you know, anyway, it seems to be going reverting. But anyway. All right. Anybody have any last words before we rush to do our dedication? Yes, Richard.
I don't want to keep extending things, but I remember in Seven Points of Mind Training, Chidren, Pema Chidren.
Yeah.
I think she was talking about Trungpa, but she said that he said to remember that even Hitler liked tacos.
Yeah.
You know, just try to remember something nice, you know, think of,
yes.
Start from there.
Well, that's actually what's worked with me when I've had trouble with people. I've told the story many times of my three-year retreat where tensions naturally grow, and I just kept a list of a way in which each of my fellow retreatants had been kind to me. So that whenever I got irritated by them, I would look at the list, and it really works. You know, your husband changed the oil in your car last month, so you didn't have to. And then when you're irritated because he left the cap off the toothpaste, you can go, I didn't have to change the oil in my car. It changes your whole mind.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, Namdak, yes, you're back.
I wanted to ask you, are you saying that we're going to be referencing Shantideva's The Way of the Bodhisattva?
Yes.
Is there a particular section or page that we're going to be reviewing?
It's in my class notes online, and I can't tell you right now what they are, but if you look at the class notes, it lists what verses, and also of the Bible, if you want to preview that. Okay, and if you don't find it, Namdak, email me, and I'll send it to you. All right. We'll do our dedication then. I'm sorry we ran a little late today. Not too bad, but... Oh, I gotta remute. Okay. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, kuntuzam kohen manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate all virtue fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. Bring our minds to rest just for a moment.